one of the volunteers at the shelter, adopted a puppy as soon as she started volunteering. Waffles is a mixed breed whom Vanessa describes as smart and sweet. After volunteering for over a year, Vanessa met Boots and adopted her too. You're invited to find your reason to adopt a great pet from Miami-Dade Animal Services. To find out more, all you have to do is dial 311 or go online to miamidade.gov/animalservices. You should make adoption your only option.
And it is today's topical current, 7 minutes past 1 o'clock on this Monday afternoon. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And this hour we visit with writer Phoebe Baker Hyde, and we discuss her dilemma of self-image and feminine perfection. She's written The Beauty Experiment, How I Skipped Lipstick, Ditched Fashion, Faced the World Without Concealer, and Learned to Love the Real Me. And she joins us from Brookline, Massachusetts. Welcome to you, Phoebe Hyde.
Hello, it's nice to be here with you.
Hi, Phoebe. Great to have you. You know, reading your book, I felt so strongly that you were on a spiritual journey to find yourself, more than just conducting a beauty experiment, albeit through rather unconventional means. Would you agree with that?
I think that's a wonderful reading. I think that's very much true, although I don't think I was aware of it at the time. But I think that's the nature of some of these journeys, is you don't really know what you're doing or what you're going after. Until you have the benefit of time to figure out what it was that you were after.
May I ask you, ladies, what is concealer? I don't even know.
Well, Phoebe, I skipped makeup today just in deference to you and the interview.
You don't look like it.
Oh, well, power to you. Power to you. I appreciate it. Concealer is a lovely viscous thing that comes in a tube or in a blotter, or in a smudger of some sort, and you ease it over those things on your face that you would rather not see.
Phoebe, from outside appearances, you were happily married, you were living fairly prosperously in Hong Kong, and you were discovering the joys of being a new mother. What was the problem?
You know, when you list all the good things, it doesn't seem like they're should be one, but our life doesn't necessarily operate by shoulds. And so what really was going on was that I was far away from a support network, and I felt unprepared for the demands of motherhood, as I think probably most parents feel unprepared. And I was also in a professional dip, I would say, not sure where to go. So I was really at a crossroads of doubt. I just didn't. A lot of stuff was coming together at the same time. And I wasn't necessarily aware that all of those things had built up, but what I was aware of was this habit or this tick that I kept turning to beauty for a self-esteem boost or for a confidence boost. And I could recognize the tick more than I could recognize all of the pressure that led to it. And I think that's often the case with bad habits, right? We know that we're doing something, but we're not quite sure of all the mess underneath that's causing us to do it. So right. I think I was in that place.
Phoebe, describe your looks before this experiment. I went online and saw a before picture of you, and you were a very pert, pretty strawberry blonde in your online photo. What's the change since this experiment?
I think, and I do address this a little bit in the book, is that if you saw the before and the after, they're not so different. I wouldn't characterize myself as a beauty junkie, and I don't think I was at the beginning of the experiment, but I definitely felt I was sort of drifting in that direction. But I did have long hair. I had hair down to the middle of my back, and I regularly used Sun-In and other lightening products on it all the time, and I felt that I was using makeup more and more as I became more and more tired as a sleep-deprived mom. And so I would say I probably had more of the mask of femininity on in those months leading up to the experiment, and then I sort of tossed that mask out, and that was a fairly significant change, I think, for me. At the end, here I am at the end, you know, much later, and I don't know that if you had looked at me in college and looked at me now, there would be a huge difference. Other than the fact that I'm much older now.
Well, there's a lot I want to ask you about now versus then. But the thing that struck me so much was you were at terrible odds with your inner voice. It was as though you were always fighting yourself. Has that changed for you?
That has changed significantly, and I feel that that is probably the essence of what was going on. And when you say spiritual journey, I think that's really a big part of it, was coming to peace with some inner antagonism there between self and drive, and so I think that was a big part of where I was working. The experiment helped with that, but there are a lot of other things that helped with that. I mean, I had to address a range of issues, and the beauty was really a lens for a lot of those other things that were going on.
You say that you would have never undertaken this journey had you not been living abroad, kind of a stranger in a strange land. Why not? And do you feel you would have missed something very important had you not?
I do feel that I would have missed something. I think the experience of being outside of the comfort zone is incredibly valuable, and it's one I've always been interested in, sort of being in that liminal space where you're just not quite sure who you are, or what you're about, particularly in a new context. I don't think I would have done it on in the U.S., particularly in the places where I was living at the time. And before we moved to Hong Kong, we lived in San Francisco, and then we moved back to suburban New Jersey when we came back again. And and both of those spots, I would have been surrounded by women who were very much like me and who were very much undergoing the same things, and we would have been having bad hair days altogether. There's a much greater tolerance in the U.S. for women in sweatpants running to the market with their hair in a ponytail. This doesn't happen in Hong Kong.
Tell us about that. Tell us about the culture in Hong Kong during your years there.
Particularly in the expatriate culture that I was in, but in the Hong Kong culture as well. It's very, there's a bit of 1950s Great Britain there, so there's a dressed up formality to the way people look. For example, nobody would wear running shoes out and about. You know, a mother with her child would not wear running shoes out and about. She would wear flats and potentially a nice dress. The child would be wearing patent leather Mary Janes. I mean, there's this a little bit old-fashioned formality, which is lovely to look at, but very hard to keep up with. And it's also saturated as the garment capital of Asia. Hong Kong is saturated with designer labels and advertising. And it's not that everybody can manage those things, because the cost of them is obviously extravagant, but it's very much a shopping culture. It's everywhere. It's a sport, it's a hobby, it's kind of the lifeblood of the city. And so when you put those two things together, the formality and the shopping culture, you end up with people who are very well groomed at all times.
I've been to Hong Kong a few times. I always say that it's the only city I know of that makes New York City look laid back.
Oh, it does. It does. And there's no element of grunge. You have to look hard to find funk. You know, you can't just go below 14th Street or something like that. You know, it's dressy everywhere.
Wow.
Did your husband have any views on this experiment, or did you care?
Of course I cared, I think some people are surprised to find that he was actually very supportive. We worked out some of the rules together. I mean, the guy saw me having these mirror meltdowns and saw that I was in a funk. And many of the times it was because there was a work party that he had invited me to, and he didn't give me enough information about how what it was, and I showed up in completely the wrong gear. And then he saw the aftermath and how bad that made me feel, and so he was supportive of me saying, well, why don't I just do it the way you do it? What if I just sort of adopt your grooming routine and do it your way and see what happens? He did have his objections. He was a stickler for the details. When I said, oh, I don't know about tinted chapstick, he said, no, that's something that I wouldn't wear, so forget it.
Right. You know, I was interested to know how you decided. You gave up the makeup, the jewelry, the shopping, the shaving, you got your hair cut. What did you have the most difficulty giving up, and how did you actually decide what to give up and what to keep?
Well, As I said, I pegged it to my husband's routine.
Okay.
So if he has a very, very minimalist grooming routine, and he has a public job where he interfaces with clients and has to be, you know, in front of groups of people speaking. So I figured if it works for him, then it can work for me. So that just meant showering, brushing teeth, you know, just getting dressed. Maybe he uses a little hair gel, but I didn't. Instead, I used a moisturizer with sunscreen in it because it's a tropical climate, and I wasn't willing to risk skin cancer for this thing, this experiment. But that was pretty much, you know, what I did. So shampoo, but no conditioner because he doesn't use conditioner. Mm. It was just a way. It was an easy rubric to adopt because I could, you know, I could sort of adopt it the whole thing without having to nickel and dime the things, although the hair maintenance one was a question. So are you going to shave your legs or not?
Right.
And ultimately I was too chicken to go with full gorilla legs, you know, in Hong Kong where I was going to be wearing shorts all the time.
Well, so, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not going any farther than this.
We're speaking with Phoebe Vager-Hyde. She's written The Beauty Experiment, How I Skipped Lipstick, Ditched Fashion, Faced the World Without Concealer, and Learned to Love the Real Me. I think we're going to shorten the title of the book, Phoebe, and the rest of
fine.
It for just The Beauty Experiment, if that's okay.
That's fine.
All right. We need to take a short break on today's Topical Currents. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. Back to the program in just a moment.
For many, a charitable bequest is a unique expression of appreciation. The thoughtfulness of many individual families, like the Levinsons and Fines, has led to planned gifts which help WLRN sustain and grow. Through your will or estate plan, you can name Friends of WLRN as the beneficiary of your estate or a portion of it, providing an enduring legacy of public media for years to come. To learn more about making an impact through planned gifts, call 305-350-7977.
St. Martha Concerts presents a benefit by Grammy-nominated jazz greats Shelley Berg, Tierney Sutton, and Carmen Bradford with the Frost Chorale, performing Shelley's Jazz Vespers Convergence, commissioned by the Dalai Lama with elements of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and Buddhism. Plus, the premiere of another composition, Saturday, April 6th at 8 p.m., St. Martha Church in Miami Shores. Tickets at 305-751-0005 or stmartha.tix.com.
And Monday edition, Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and writer Phoebe Vager-Hyde. Her book is called The Beauty Experiment. Tell me, Phoebe Vager-Hyde, what about the tons of money spent by women on manis and pedis? Do you forego that too? Or?
I did during my experiment, and it was an interesting part of my experiment because I thought that I would had a grand scheme of donating all the money that I ordinarily would have spent. And there are plenty of statistics out there about how much women spend a year, a day on appearance. And I think they're all a little bit different, and they're all sort of designed to make us feel guilty and bad about spending money on our appearance. I think those statistics do have that effect. And they worked on me, and that was part of the conception of my experiment, was to say, okay, well, I'll do good with that instead of doing bad, right? I shouldn't be spending it on myself. I should be donating it. And that that mindset actually backfired during my experiment for a couple reasons, and that was interesting to me. On for one on one side of it, I realized that I didn't want to spend time shopping and recording all the money that I ordinarily would have spent, because I wanted to break free from that mindset. So going into a store was actually counterproductive. So that was one reason. And the other was that generosity is not an either or proposition. Generosity is a both and. You do for yourself what you need, and you do for others what you can. And I think the denial of taking the money away, or taking the self-care away from the self and giving it to another, sets up sort of a bad dynamic. It's the same with dieting, right? I mean, if we've been on a diet, the minute you say, well, I can't do this, I'm not going to do this, then the impulse to splurge is there, right?
Right.
So instead of saying, well, I'm not going to do this, instead I'm going to do this, I had to find a way to do both in a way that felt that I was taking care of myself and that I also had resources to help others with. And so that conception took some doing to come to.
And even though I want to stay more on the experiment, I realize you said today that you pay a portion of your beauty wealth forward. How do you do that now?
Well, I have a, on my website, I have a list of organizations and charities that I contribute to, some on a regular basis, some on a, gosh, that seems important to me today, basis. And it's not huge amounts, but it was very empowering to make a list of places that I wanted to support and felt important to me. And it's an empowering exercise, I think, for any person, not just women, because I think sometimes the requests we receive in the mail can sort of inundate us and make us feel guilty. But if we flip it and take a proactive approach and say, I know I want to put myself out in the world, and I know that I have this much time, or I have this much money, or this many resources, or this much expertise that I can give back. You know, if you take the lead on those things, you're not trapped in this guilt cycle. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. What is your website, by the way?
It's www.phoebebakerhyde.com.
And that's Phoebe, in case our listeners want to check it out. And Hyde is Hyde.
Yes.
If you'd like to speak to Phoebe Baker-Hyde on today's Topical Currents about her beauty experiment or her spiritual journey, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio at WLRN.org. That's radio at WLRN.org. At some point, you decided to cover up nearly all the mirrors in your apartment, of which there were very many. Why? And tell us what the result was and how that worked.
Well, this was part of that inner voice, that there. I realized how nasty that inner voice had become, that I was having a dialogue with my reflection. And a lot of this happened because the apartments in Hong Kong tend to be much smaller than apartments here, and as a result, covered with mirrors to increase the light and the appearance of a larger space. So we had mirrors in every room in the house. And so I had this friend, this bad friend with me in every room, and she was my reflection, and she was always commenting and, you know, do it this way, stop chewing with your mouth open, that shirt looks terrible. And I just needed to get rid of her. I needed to ditch that bad friend. And so I found big pieces of wrapping paper and put them up over the mirrors, and that was one of the few things that had an immediate positive effect. Some of the other things I did during the experiment took some time for the effects to be seen, but that worked right away. All of a sudden, instead of being two people, a doer and a watcher, I was just me. I was just one person, and I think that sensation of fully embodying yourself, of not being split and not watching, not spectating yourself, but of being completely immersed in your activity, whatever it is you're doing. That's a flow state. That's a flow experience, and I think it happens to us when we're shooting a three-pointer, or when we're biking down a hill, or when we're doing the best work we can. We forget to watch ourselves, and we just do the thing we're doing.
Right.
And
how does the financial dependence of many women on men figure in their looks and their self-image?
Well, that's a big question. I think he'll need to read probably a couple books to answer that one. But I think the valuation of women's beauty as a currency almost, it goes back to the beginning of time, and there were times when women were property. Women couldn't own property because they were property. And I think there's a bunch of old baggage that we are carrying around, some of us to this day, and many of us are not. And I want to be very clear that my experience is very different from other women that I've heard feedback from. And like some other, you know, there's a big range here. But I think that there are a couple things going on with dependent women, and one of them is this baggage of beauty as being your value. The other one is that the work of caregiving is very undervalued in our society. And caregiving is incredible monetary value, incredible civic value. The work of raising children or caring for elders or giving care in the community, these things almost never get paid. And yet, without them, the world falls apart. And so I feel that, I think that's a big piece of value that sometimes that women underplay as well, and so put a higher price tag on their appearance because these other things aren't valued publicly.
And of course, it starts so young. I mean, we still have little kid beauty contests and things like that, and they're wearing mascara and all that jazz. It just seems kind of weird that they're indoctrinated so early on in life.
It's true. It's true. There's an aspect of my experiment. I did a survey, an online survey of 400 plus women and about 100 men, just assessing their attitudes toward beauty. And the responses were all over the map, but there were a couple questions that really had a unified answer. And one of them was, how comfortable are you with girly girl products and princess paraphernalia? And a majority said that they were either uncomfortable or conflicted about these products. And I think at least with the women I know, the moms I know, there's a confusion that, yes, we love to dress up, we love to look great. Of course we don't want our daughters to think that getting married and living happily ever after is the trajectory of their lives. And that yet there's not a lot of middle ground as far as those products go.
Phoebe, I want to go back to the mirrors for a second and then move.
Sure.
I have so many questions for you, but you talked about how it kind of rectified a split for you. What is your relationship with mirrors today?
It's actually much better. The mirrors are limited to the bathroom and the places where I do grooming. Grooming is something that we all do for each other.
So you're not like Dracula or anything.
We try not to walk around without spinach in our teeth.
Right.
Now this is right. And I feel that a spot check is a useful thing, is a necessary thing before we face the day. But I've limited the number of mirrors in our house because I think having a lot of them around just causes us to look more often. Some of us are completely uninterested, but frankly, put a mirror in front of a room full of people and they're going to start checking themselves out and then becoming split.
Right.
And I want, for my children and for myself, because we spend a lot of time in the home, they're young, I would like us to achieve more flow state than split state at this point.
You know, speaking of your children, your daughter Hattie will eventually become a teenager. And I was thinking whether from peer pressure or just living in our society, she may want to experiment with makeup and fashion. How are you going to handle that?
She will make her own decisions for sure. And right now, she's young enough that you know, we're focusing on eating healthy foods and getting lots of exercise and doing the jobs that we need to do around the house and taking joy in them. I mean, that's kind of where we are. However, I do feel that there are a couple specific things that I learned that I will be very happy to share with her. And one of them, these are not draconian anti-makeup measures at all, but I'd love her to see me enjoying the process of getting dressed up and not having mirror meltdowns, and for her to think that adornment is this lovely, fun, exciting, even dangerous part of human expression, and we do it once in a while, and men and women both do it equally. I mean, men like to get dressed up too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, and to see a positive approach to that instead of an anxious, oh my gosh, I can't get it right, I don't like the way it looks, that kind of approach.
What about jewelry?
Kind of the same thing. I mean, I actually like jewelry a lot more than makeup. Jewelry reminds me of people that I love that have given it to me. So right now I'm at a place of just one thing. You know, I just wear one thing that gives me that little boost of appearance, self-confidence, and I pretty much only wear it when I have an occasion when I'm in public. And I think I'll try to hand these rules to her and let her figure out her own as far as appearance goes, but I do think something that's been very good for me is to limit the amount of shopping and magazine browsing that I do,
mm-hmm.
because I find that if I start with myself, what do I need, what are the things that would be useful to me, and then look, I do a much better job of selecting wisely than if I go out and say, flip through a catalog and see all the nice things that are there.
We're speaking with Phoebe Baker Hyde. She's written The Beauty Experiment, and it's Topical Currents. We're going to take another short break. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll return to the program in just a moment.
The Southeast Florida Action Network, known as CFAN, is a reporting and response system that helps keep Southeast Florida's coral reefs safe. Vessel groundings, invasive species, coral bleaching, marine debris, and fish kills are all incidents that are signs of trouble for Southeast Florida's coral reefs. You can help protect the ocean by reporting signs of trouble at CFAN.net or 1-866-770-SEFL. CFAN, we're all connected. Keep it protected.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
The classic coming-of-age story of universal teenage angst gets a fresh twist when the high-energy rock musical Bear returns to South Florida. Compared to Rent and Spring Awakening, set to an electrifying rock music score, critics are calling Bear the best musical of 2012, playing for 1 week only at the Broward Center, March 27th through 30th. Tickets at 954-462-0222 or browardcenter.org.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Phoebe Baker Hyde about her book, The Beauty Experiment. If you want to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576.
I'm surprised we haven't gotten any calls.
Yeah, me too. Or you can email radio at WLRN.org. Phoebe, one thing that kind of puzzled me, I don't remember what the problem was exactly. You were diagnosed with a foot problem. Was it a ligament sprain or...
Capsulitis. Who knows what that means?
What's it called?
Capsulitis.
Capsulitis. And your feet were killing you, and yet because you weren't shopping, you didn't go get the necessary shoes. Don't you think that was going a little too far?
Yeah, that might have been. I mean, the truth is, in retrospect, I really understand what happened during that experiment year as a temper tantrum. I mean, I was kicking and screaming on the floor of the mall and saying, I won't do it. If I can't have it my way, I'm not going to do it at all.
Right.
And that's really, that's a three-year-old way to behave. But what tantrums do is they really draw immediate attention to problem areas or problem people or problems. So, and I did take care of that as soon as that was the very first thing I bought.
Yes.
When that was over. And I had plenty of sneakers. I just didn't want to wear them because they didn't look great. So that was one reason why I didn't go out and buy the nice sandals. I mean, or the, orthotic sandals, was because I could wear my closed-toe shoes. They might have been a little bit hot. They might have been a little bit not stylish, but I had them. So I think there's a degree in which the word, I wanted to push the boundaries of the word need a little bit. I need these shoes. Well, what is need? Is need, I want them because they look better? Or I want them because I don't actually have any other shoes to wear. So, that's that intermediate place that I was talking about. In order to challenge our definitions, to challenge what we think words mean, sometimes we have to live a little bit outside of those definitions to spread them wider. And I think that's ultimately what I did with the word beauty in this experiment. In order to in order to ask my mind to broaden its scope, I had to live in a place that wasn't necessarily what I thought of as beautiful at first.
Are there parallels, say, to the stereotype of metrosexual men and being self-absorbed?
Possibly. I think there's also an interesting parallel to the narrowness of self-expression that's allowed in a traditional masculine look. That men are beyond all of this, and that appearances don't matter as much to men, and that even personal life, I mean, for women, right, your couch is you. It's in some strange way. Your clothing choice represents you, which is, I think, a correlation that's probably overplayed. In men, it's the opposite. Your suit shows nothing about you. So you're accepted only on the things that you do, not the things that you wear or the way that you look.
You can get away with being rumpled.
Sure, because it's not about how you look, right? It's about what you say and what you do. And I think that's actually short-sighted because, frankly, you are being judged on how you look, and women are being judged on what they do. And I think part of this experiment, much of it, lies at this crux between these shifting gender roles that we're encountering today, as far as breadwinner and caregiver and stay at home or work at home or work at an office or flex time. I mean, I think there's a lot that's changing. And in some ways, I think this the hyper-feminization is a bit of a backlash, but it's a weird backlash that maybe women exert against themselves or something. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on this, but
Do you consider your experience or the book to be feminist?
I don't think I would have said so at the time when I was doing it, because I don't, during the experiment, I wasn't even looking that far. But the experiment opened up several cans of worms, that beauty was like a lens, and I used it to look at all of these different things. And then once I started looking, I really recognized, oh my gosh, the requirements for women's appearance in the workplace is totally unlike the appearance, the requirements for men, and that's an issue. And then, oh my gosh, caregiving is totally undervalued. That's an issue. And oh my gosh, my husband is stuck in this corporate environment. If I had his job, how would I be a part of my family? That's an issue. So it sort of became a path. It definitely became a pathway to understanding that there was work to be done. And I think those challenges play out of the feminist agenda, and yet
right.
I think that movement is ripe to open up to all people. I mean, the stay-at-home dads have a really hard time. And I think their concerns are the same as my. So I think the gender bias of feminism is something that's still very important in a lot of realms. But I also hope that movement opens up to include, you know, couples of all stripes and professions and caregivers of all makes.
We have lines open, 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Bonnie will also take your email. That's radio@WLRN.org. First caller, this is Robert in Deerfield Beach. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good.
I just love your book. It's a great opener for a lot of men, too. When I was in college in Memphis, my fraternity, it was a pledge prank. They asked me to dress in drag, and it was really humiliating. So I got a long dress, but then they gave me a short dress. So I had to shave my legs and my armpits, and I didn't realize what women go through. And I showed up with Band-Aids all over my legs, and they said, "What happened to you?" And I said, "Industrial mosquitoes, you know. It's right here in the Mississippi Delta." And in the last years of my life, my mother's life, when she was in her 90s, I took care of her. So it was the opposite. I was dressing my mother, and when I first put her dress on her backwards, we both agreed it looked better that way. I was amazed, and she laughed a lot. And she said, "Now you know." And I said, I did. I think that one thing that might add to the conversation is that our appearance, while being physical, isn't just putting things on our body, but what our body looks like naked. And I think that means making the good choices. And I think that your book helps people with that.
Any comment, Phoebe Baker-Hyde?
I think there was definitely a big health aspect of this experiment that just came out of nowhere, and I think this really plays to, was it Robert,
his right.
comment? Yes.
You know, those first weeks when I went without concealer, I had terrible, terrible purple circles, and I just thought, oh my God, I'm not going to make it through a year looking the way I do. And yet I was committed to not wearing the makeup, and I had to take a step back and say, well, maybe I need to get some more sleep. Maybe I need to take a look at my diet. Maybe I need to check in with my hormone situation.
I always wonder how women get around on those spike heels. I couldn't conceive of walking on those things.
And frankly, they're not great for your toes.
Or your back.
Or your back, right, right. So, and that's... And
they
that
do
is
make
something
that... legs look pretty good, though.
Well, you know, and there were some lasting effects. I mean, I have really turned into... I left makeup junkie behind and became a sleep junkie. I mean, I really work hard to instill good sleep habits in my children, and I've given up on my husband because he's just terrible. He stays up late, you know, whatever. But you know, it really impacts the way we feel about ourselves, and it impacts the way we treat other people. Sleep deprivation is a huge national public health issue, and it's really underaddressed. But it falls along the lines of the public health issues of obesity and diabetes and heart disease and all of this stuff. I think in some ways a frenzy of appearance anxiety can cover up those deeper issues that you know, if you feel fit and well rested, makeup doesn't do that much for you.
That's true.
It helps. It helps a little bit, particularly if you're in a professional setting and you need to be a little bit larger than life. But as far as dealing with your real life situation of handling your kids or driving on the freeway or cooking your dinner or whatever leisure time, if you're well rested and fed well and you're in good shape, and you feel pretty good.
We're speaking with Phoebe Baker-Hyde. Her book is The Beauty Experiment, and it's Topical Currents. Phoebe, stay with us, and all of you, we need to take another break.
And you are listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM, also streaming online 24 hours a day at WLRN.org.
Shaking like a leaf on a tree.
Five-time Grammy Award winner Diana Krall brings the Glad Rag Doll Tour to Miami. On April 2nd, the Arch Center will kick off the U.S. tour, featuring music from Krall's new critically acclaimed studio album, Glad Rag Doll, which has been described as an exhilarating and adventurous exploration of new sounds, new instrumentation, and new musicians. Diana Krall, April 2nd at the Adrian Arch Center. Information at archcenter.org.
Miami City Ballet presents Program 4, Broadway and Ballet, featuring audience favorites. Jerome Robbins' Piano Ballet, Dances at a Gathering, and George Balanchine's Rowdy Slaughter on 10th Avenue, from the hit Broadway musical On Your Toes. Program 4 opens April 5th in Palm Beach, April 26th in Fort Lauderdale, and May 3rd in Miami. Tickets at MiamiCityBallet.org or 877-929-7010.
Thanks to the more than 3,700 people who contributed during our WLRN Spring Fund Drive, we came up somewhat short of our goal for this drive, but listeners' support remains our most important source of income. If you did contribute, that money will help pay for the WLRN and NPR news and entertainment programs you'll hear in the coming months. If you didn't get a chance to give, you can still do so online at WLRNradio.org or call 1-866-247-9576. Thanks for making everything we do possible.
And we're back. It is Topical Currents for Monday. We're speaking with Phoebe Baker-Hyde. She's written The Beauty Experiment, How I Skipped Lipstick, Ditched Fashion, Faced the World Without Concealer, and Learned to Love the Real Me. Phoebe, if you had your druthers, who would you have read your book, and what would you like them to take away from it?
Oh, that's a great question. I feel that it... The person I wish I had had this book to read when I was 18 or 19. And so I hope to connect with some readers in that age, a college student who is still forming her ideas about how the world works and hasn't yet moved into that place of ultimate female power that is your 20s.
Right.
I don't know, my 20s, I felt like the world was my oyster. I was on top of it, and I really didn't have any time for, I don't know. I felt like women's issues were something that had already been taken care of. And I feel that that's something that's out there a little bit, or maybe a lot, today. However, if I'd read this book when I was younger, I probably would have carried some of that information with me, and it would have been useful to me when I ran up against, and when I think many women run up against the reality of the professional world coming, crashing against the media world, crashing against family obligations, crashing against this, you know, having to take care of your parents and your children at the same time. I mean, I think in women's 30s and 40s, it's sort of you have to do everything all the time, all at once. And that was what inspired my temper tantrum that was this beauty experiment, this feeling of I have to do it all, and I think that's ridiculous. Why do I have to do it all?
We're kind of short on time.
Okay.
Phoebe, let's take a call or two. This is Kamala in North Miami. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on how familiar this conversation feels about the process as an African-American woman that I went through when I decided to go natural and to stop processing my hair. And it's a lot of the same. You get messages that that part of who you are, your hair in its natural state, is not beautiful, and that your hair should be long, and there's sort of status in the community that's also connected to how you look and how you present yourself. And it's been a similar process of having to let go and make peace with it and allowing it to do whatever it wants. And, you know, there's also issues like within my family, even around the complexion, you know, how dark or fair skin that you are. And so, you know, it kind of just has a lot of parallels to what my experience was as a young woman and now a slightly older woman.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think that's really interesting, and I think it parallels also with what some women have told me about going gray after having dyed their hair for many, many years, and then it's a bold jump at times if you've dyed it for many years and then you suddenly change. And I don't know how your process was, but I know that you could sort of do it all at once and then suffer the repercussions, or you could do sort of gradually move into it, and these have different reactions from people. And I think I would, if Kamala's still there, how do you feel now, and how long has it been?
I feel great. It's been a few years now, and this is actually my second attempt at it, and I sort of gave up the first time, and I'm natural now and going gray. So I'm having the same kind of conversation around, like, whether or not I'll color my hair. And there's even a whole industry now about helping black women transition if they want to go natural, whether you're just going to chop off all of your hair and do it all at once, or there's now products that'll help ease it and help you still feel beautiful and look presentable while you're figuring out what to do with this new texture of hair that you're going to be living with. So.
That's so wonderful. That's so great to hear, because I think the transition is the hard part. You know, growing out your bangs or trying on a new pair of glasses that are totally different or changing your style. I mean, it's hard to go from one extreme to another, and that's when you're going to get the comments, I think. But the gradual transition can ease it up. And I also feel like this is a time to make a call for advertisers and for those who make images of women and men to just give us a wider... Give us more images that reflect our the reality of who women are. I saw this wonderful spot not too long ago. 60-year-old woman, gray hair down to her butt, and it was so stunning. And I thought, yes, I'd love to see 5 of these every day. You know, I'd love to see, you know, you, Kamala, on the billboard and saying, look, this is how it is. Isn't it great? You know, and I think there's some motion in that direction, but we could use even more.
Okay, let's take another caller.
Thanks
now.
So much for calling,
yeah.
Kamala.
Mm-hmm. This is, let's see, we have another Phoebe, Palm Beach. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about whether you think the dual role that you speak about, the doer and then the watcher in the mirror, if that's a core part of women judging one another, both in the workplace, in the home sphere. I know a lot of my girlfriends, colleagues, and I speak about how we find other women are each other's harshest critics when we would hope we would be supporting one another. Do you think it really comes down to us healing the rift within ourselves before we can tackle this bigger issue, or if we should start from a higher level and work down?
I think this is an amazing question, and I'm going to just go right to the heart of it, which is, yes, I think you have to heal yourself first.
Okay.
I think that's, the word compassion is really easy to talk about, and I actually think it's really hard to do, to actually be compassionate toward yourself, toward your flaws, toward your mistakes, and compassionate not in a sort of a weak, mushy way, but compassionate and say, well, I did that, and these are the consequences, and okay, do I like that or do I not like that, and do I want to do something different? I mean, this is really at the very heart of what this experiment was about, and I still struggle with that compassion, being compassionate toward myself, but I see in my young daughter, I see even her getting so frustrated with herself when she wrecks on her bike, and she's only been riding for, you know, a couple months, and her ability to judge herself harshly is, you know, sort of already there. And so I feel that it's my job as a mom, it's my job as a person to just model for myself and for her this compassionate, non-judgmental approach to the self, so that we can do it toward other women. And I do think there are ways to approach that judgment toward other women sort of more from top down. But I think the work has to start on the inside.
Phoebe, ironically, this morning I received these thoughts for the day by email. I'd like to read you today's and ask you just for a moment. We have to close in just 30 seconds, so I'll just read it. Self-acceptance is an agreement with yourself to appreciate, validate, and support who you are right now, even those parts you'd like to change. Look at yourself in the mirror. Take a moment to love and accept the person you see looking back at you.
It's a great message. It's a hard one, but it's great work for all of us to do.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasure spending the hour with you. We've been visiting with writer Phoebe Baker Hyde, and the name of her book is The Beauty Experiment, How I Skipped Lipstick, Ditched Fashion, Faced the World Without Concealer, and Learned to Love the Real Me. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much
Thank
for
you,
having
Phoebe.
Me. Have a great day.
You too.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and past programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow we examine the history of the Florida State Mental Hospital at Chattahoochee. Its notorious reputation of cruelty and abuse is chronicled by journalist Sally Ling in her book, Out of Sight, Out of Mind.
Happy Passover.
And to the calendar, on this day in 1822, 191 years ago, Naval Lieutenant Matthew Perry raises the American flag over Key West, Florida, officially declaring U.S. sovereignty over the Florida Keys. As an admiral, of course, Perry would spearhead the opening of Japan in 1853. And on this day, 1934, 79 years ago, the birth of feminist and publisher Gloria Steinem in Toledo, Ohio. After becoming a strong voice in the modern feminist movement, she founded and edited Ms. Magazine. She was also the first female speaker at the National Press Club. And one more while we burn down the mission. On this day in 1947, 66 years ago, the birth of Reginald Kenneth Dwight in Middlesex, England. Elton John. The best-selling single of all time is his remake of Candle in the Wind, circa 1997. We leave with this from Gloria Steinem, quote, "From pacifist to terrorist, each person condemns violence, and then adds one cherished case in which it may be justified." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.
This is 91.